The Old Testament reading today is from Psalms 87. Listen, let us listen to the words of the Lord. This is the word of the Lord. On the holy mount stands the city he founded. The Lord loves the gates of Zion more than all the dwellings of Jacob. Glorious things are spoken of you, a city of God. Among those who knew me, I mentioned Reba and Babylon, Philistina and to Tyre and to Ethiopia. This was one born there, they say. And of Zion it shall be said, this one that one was were born in it. For the Most High himself will establish it. The Lord records as he registers the people. This one was born there. Singers and dancers alike say, all my springs are in you. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Our New Testament reading this morning is from Luke chapter 15, verses 11 through 31. Let us listen for the word of the Lord. To illustrate the point further, Jesus told them this story. A man had two sons. The younger son told his father, I want my share of your estate now before you die. So his father agreed to divide his wealth between his sons. A few days later, this younger son packed all his belongings and moved to a distant land, and there he wasted all his money in wild living. About this time, his money ran out. A great famine swept over the land, and he began to starve. He persuaded a local farmer to hire him, and the man sent him into his fields to feed the pigs. The young man became so hungry that even the pods he was feeding the pigs looked good to him, but no one gave him anything. When he finally came to his senses, he said to himself, at home, even the hired servants have food enough to spare, and here I am dying of hunger. I will go home to my father and say, Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy of being called your son. Please take me on as a hired servant. So he returned home to his father. And while he was still a long way off, his father saw him coming. Filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son, embraced him, and kissed him. His son said to him, Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy of being called your son. But his father said to the servants, Quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet. And kill the calf we have been fattening. We must celebrate with a feast, for this son of mine was dead and has now returned to life. He was lost, but now he is found. So the party began. Meanwhile, the older son was in the fields working. When he returned home, he heard music and dancing in the house, and he asked one of the servants what was going on. Your brother is back, he was told, and your father has killed the fattened calf. We are celebrating because of his safe return. The older brother was angry and wouldn't go in. His father came out and begged him. But he replied, All these years I've slaved for you and never once refused to do a single thing you told me to. And in all that time, you never gave me even one young goat for a feast with my friends. Yet when this son of yours comes back after squandering your money on prostitutes, you celebrate by killing the fattened calf? His father said to him, Look, dear son, you have always stayed by me, and everything I have is yours. We have to celebrate this happy day, for your brother was dead and has come back to life. He was lost, but now he is found. This is the word of the Lord. The Jewish nation had a serious problem because their narrative, their story of their lives, their existence, was that they were God's specially chosen people, that God was uniquely with and for them in a way that was not true of the surrounding nations, that they were blessed by God. The problem was that they kept finding themselves a conquered people. What does God's blessing and witness mean if they are repeatedly being hauled off to Egypt and then being attacked by Philistines and overrun, and then being hauled off to Babylon, and then being conquered by Rome. Why isn't God's blessing and presence translating into a more abundant, successful present? It's a problem, right? Of course, how you deal with that was all over the map. But one of the more prevalent ways of explaining why God could be for them, but that this wasn't working out very well, was, of course, that the problem was within them as a people. Not all of them, of course. Just the ones who weren't doing what God said. That the problem was those disobedient sons, as it were, who weren't following the law, who weren't doing what God asked them to do. And so by the time Jesus had arrived, there was a very distinct set of, well, it was the Pharisees is how we know them, a class of people who believed that the problem with the Jewish nation and why God wasn't allowed to bless them the way he hoped to was very much because they weren't following God's laws. And that if they followed God's laws effectively and perfectly, that God would be able to bless them and be with them and for them and would allow them to conquer their enemies and no longer be living under this curse. And of course, these Pharisees believed that if we could just get our acts together and follow all of these rules, then God would be able to heal our nation. He would be able to make us a place where we weren't under the boot of some other empire, those godless Romans, and that everything would be okay. The problem was with those people who wouldn't follow the rules. They were known as sinners. The righteous, on the other hand, followed God's command. There was this very elaborate 613 commands in the Old Testament. Most of those have to do with ritual purity. And you had to be able to keep yourself pure and clean and able to connect with God. There were all sorts of things that could make you impure. Touching anything dead, being involved with any sort of unclean issue. I mean, sorry, ladies, for a week, a month, you are unclean and you have to leave the camp. There's also, and if you didn't follow these rules and you didn't go through offering these sacrifices and paying these fines, it was a very complicated system. If you didn't do this, you were a sinner and you were the problem. You were the reason God wasn't able to bless Israel and Judah. You've all heard the story of the prodigal son before. Of course, it's one of the most famous stories Jesus tells. But I'd like to read you the context to this story. Luke chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. Tax collectors and other notorious sinners often came to listen to Jesus teach. This made the Pharisees and the teachers of religious law complain that he was associating with such sinful people, even eating with them. So Jesus told them these stories. And there's three stories, of course, Jesus tells in Luke chapter 15. The story of the lost sheep, the story of the lost coin, and the story of the lost son. The context of this story is very much a politically charged culture where there are people who are in and are following God, and there are people who are the problem, and the reason things aren't going the way we want is because of them. Sound familiar? It might have relevance today, I don't know. The fascinating part of this, and Jesus just starts punking them from the beginning, and we don't even get it. Part of Jewish, well, it wasn't just Jewish society, but at the time, and I mentioned this before, I think in the last couple months, but it was a very stratified society, right? There were people, there were haves, there were mediums, there were lower mediums, there were have-nots, there were slaves, they were untouchable. It was a very rigid caste system, as it were, and the more... The lower down you got, the worse the jobs got, and the more unclean you became. And of course, some of the most unclean people would have been the shepherds. I mean, they had to sleep with sheep. They stunk. I quoted Plato before saying that you can't handle being around shepherds because the odor will just knock you over. If you've been to the Middle East... It is true. It is amazing. I walked into a foundry where they were taking the tannery where they were taking the sheep hides, and the smell was a wall. Shepherds were considered incredibly unclean, and for righteous people, this starts off with just an absolute irony, where Jesus says, If one of you had 100 sheep, who's he talking to? Pharisees, who would never think about owning sheep or being a shepherd, because that was unclean work and that would separate them from God, and that was part of the problem. And Jesus starts this all off with this incredibly ironic story about people who own sheep and would take care of even one lost sheep and would put that on their shoulders and carry it back. And of course, Jesus is hoping for us to get a glimpse of eternal reality, of what God actually thinks and is up to in this world. And he paints this picture of a God who is willing to go and put an unclean sheep on his shoulders and with joy carry that sheep home and celebrate. There's something that one will preach too, another day. And he tells the story of a widow who loses a coin and looks through her entire house to find the coin. And then he tells the story of a son. Two lines into this story is impossible, improbable, and preposterous. A man had two sons. The younger son told his father, "I want my share of your estate now." You probably know this, but at the time, an inheritance was divided after the death of the patriarch. And the older son would usually get a double portion of what everyone else got, and then everyone else divides the rest of it equally. And so for a younger son to come to his father and say, "I want my share of your wealth and your estate now," is very much saying, "I wish you were dead. Can we just skip this process and get on to the part where I get your things?" It is very much a statement of, "I'd rather have your stuff than you." You don't get a much more insulting statement than that. Especially in a culture, and we think that's bad, and in the culture at the time, the patriarch was revered. The patriarch was the person you honored and respected. In fact, the fifth commandment says, "You shall honor your mother and father, that your days might be long upon the earth." This is not honoring. This is a flagrant violation of everything that holds society together, of everything that is decent and true. This son deserves to be stoned for insulting his father, for telling his father he wishes his father was dead. So, two lines in, crazy story. Everyone at this point is like, this son is the villainest of villains. booing and hissing. And then something even crazier happens in line three, right? What does the father do? Incomprehensible. The father says, "Here you go." This is mind-blowing. This is not something anyone would ever conceive. If it was a preposterous request, it is a doubly preposterous response. "Here you go." See, the way things usually worked is that the father of the family would be working, building the wealth. And so to take that wealth early, of course, diminishes what is left over for everyone else. The younger son's not just cutting into the father, he's also cutting into the older brother's share as well. He's cutting into the family. What would be involved in getting that share of the wealth now and translating that into money? It's going to be selling off herds and sheep. It might be leasing out land. Who knows what's involved, but it's going to be a cost to the family. And obviously, the younger son does not care. "Just give me my stuff." And the father does it. And of course, the next part of the story is not much of a surprise, right? Anybody who does something that selfish and awful is probably going to keep making horrible mistakes, and he does. And it says he goes off to a far-off land. He leaves, obviously he's leaving Israel because he's someplace where they keep pigs, and that would not have, there's some more deep, Jesus is digging this hole as deep as he can. This kid is forced to work with the pigs. It's as low as it gets. He's as unclean as it gets. He is as much of the problem as could possibly be conceived of. If there is something wrong with Israel, it is this kid. Let's stone him. We'll fix the problem. We will become a pure nation. God will be able to bless us when we rid ourselves of people like this son. That's what everybody's thinking at this point. which is why this story is so cool. Because when he returned home, the first thing everyone wants done is, of course, a great big, I told you so, and let's stone this kid now. As he walks past the village elders on his way, they're probably like, sweet, we've been wanting some justice for a while. Here it comes. Can't wait to see the father put him in his place. Because if anyone deserves it, it's this kid. And this might be my favorite picture in the entire Bible. This picture of God that Jesus himself gives us. Of the old man, the father, sitting on the porch. And to be able to see his son coming from a long way off means he has been watching. The old man jumps up, clutches his robes, and runs. If you are dignified, it's still like this in some, you don't run. Elders don't run. It's not safe. No. But in the culture, honor and respect, people waited for you. You did not, only people who were being chased run, right? No. The father, the dignified patriarch who has done nothing wrong, gets up and runs towards his son. Throws his arms around him in an embrace. The son has just been where? With the pigs. I can imagine how he smells. If the father's concerned about ceremonial cleanliness, he's sure not showing us very well. He throws his arms around his son. He gives no figs about ceremonially uncleanliness. He doesn't care about anything other than that this is his son and his son is back. And he throws the robe, the symbol of his house. He has the ring put on his finger. And a ring, by the way, at the time had the father's seal and signet on it. And it implied that anyone with that ring could make decisions for the father. He puts the ring on his son's finger. He invites him home. He has the fattened calves. I saw this funny cartoon this last week that shows these cows sitting around the corral. And one of them, who is much girthier than the others, is leaning there saying, I don't mean to brag, but I just heard the master's having a party and I'm the only one invited. Yeah. Good luck with that. He has a party, he has a feast, and it says there's dancing and music and this massive celebration. Of course, I'm going to step this back just for a minute, because the younger son, in spite of the fact that he came home, he doesn't really get the father at all, does he? I mean, his thought processes in this are that, well, I'm starving here and my father's workers aren't, so at least I could go back, and if I go back there, maybe I can get a job, because the people who have jobs at my father's ranch have it far better off than this pigsty where I can't even eat the pods. So he thinks he can go back and earn a place in the family, right? Does he understand the father? No way. He does not get it. He thinks he can earn his food, that he can earn a place and earn belonging. So he goes back and the father showers him with lavish, extravagant welcome. And the older brother, of course, is the second half of this story. The older brother is angry and refuses to enter in. I think this is pretty profound too. What does the father do in response to that? You might have missed this. His father came out. The father leaves the party and comes to the older son as well. The father isn't just running to the younger son. The father is coming to both kids, to all the kids. The older son misunderstands the father every bit as much as the younger son, right? His speech to his dad, all these years I've slaved for you. And you never once gave me a part. The older son thinks the exact same thing, right? He thinks he's got to earn the father's approval. He just thinks he's done it. Like, I did what you asked me to do. I have been working my tail off for all these years, and you haven't even thrown me a party. And the father shakes his head, and it's just, you don't get it. I love the words Jesus chooses to put in the father's mouth here. Son, I am always with you, and all I have is yours. That's what the father's saying. And for those of us who tend towards being older sons, there might be no better mantra than playing that in our heads over and over and over. My child, I am always with you, and all I have is yours. You thought you were earning your place at the table? Get over here! No! No, you, son, you have not understood any of this. You have been at the party the entire time. You just weren't coming in. You have been with me always. All I have is yours. This is the party. It's your fault that you thought you were working for all my good pleasure and favor and stuff. That's not how it works. You're my son, and all I have is yours. And he's my son. And what matters most is that we are together, so let us celebrate. This story is amazing. For a group of people who think the problem is them, what does this say? You are all my kids. None of you are earning the Father's favor. That's not how this works. My kids don't earn my love. They couldn't. There's nothing they could do to get me to love them more, and there is nothing they can do to get me to love them any less. That's not how being a child of the Father is structured. We are God's kids simply because He is our Father. That's what it takes, and that's been done. As Jesus says, it is finished. You are my kids. How we relate to that, how we go from there, is of course what matters immensely, because we choose what we do with this belonging in this place. The Father is extravagantly welcoming us. By the way, it's probably worth defining the terms here. Extravagant means lacking restraint, costing too much, exceeding what is reasonable or appropriate, absurd. To welcome, to gladly receive in this extravagant, absurd, over-the-top way is reflecting the image of God. That is how God welcomes us. And prodigal, of course, kind of means the same thing. It's an old English word which means wasteful, extravagant, spendthrift, lavish, imprudent, excessive. And we've always called this the story of the prodigal son, but I would argue that it is not. This is the story of the prodigal father. This is not about the son, because this is the story of two sons. This is a story of a father who loves with a wasteful, extravagant, spendthrift, lavish, imprudent, and excessive love. It changes both kids' lives. Both kids are invited into this party. Jesus is trying to get us as human beings to see God in this different light. What if God loved with a prodigal love? What if we have a prodigal God? Might change how we treat our brothers and sisters, right? I mean, the older son's biggest concern is how much of the pie is left over for him. The youngest son's concern is, can I get my pie now? What if it wasn't about, what if the pie was unlimited? What if God is big enough that there was place and welcome and enough for everyone, and we didn't have to worry about scrapping with each other for our peace? I think this might change how we treat each other, how we treat the people who might be fighting for the same piece of pavement on the road, or fighting for the same banana in the grocery store. There might be more than enough for all of us. We can afford to be prodigal like our God. We can afford to be generous and to extend this extravagant welcome that has been extended to us. The Father says, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. This joy of the Father's He invites us for that to be our joy too. When we start seeing one another as brothers and sisters instead of competitors or threats, this opens us up to this incredible world where joy is possible at every corner, right? Like if it's not about me grabbing what I can, and in turn is about instead me being able to give whatever I can to whatever person I'm interacting with, because there's always something, right? It does not have to be fine. In fact, I feel most given to when people are simply giving warmth and love and acceptance and encouragement. Are those things finite? No. In fact, the more you give, the more you probably have. We each have immense opportunities for extending this extravagant welcome to the people around us. You might have missed it. I'm going to read my version of that Old Testament Psalm 87. I gave you some of the history in the introduction, but if you were Israel and you could pick the three worst nations in your history, who would you pick? Egypt? Rome was newer than Psalms, but yes, at the time this was written, Babylon, and only a boy named David. Philistines, right? Awful. Let me read this. On the holy mountain stands the city founded by the Lord. He loves the city of Jerusalem more than any other city in Israel. O city of God, what glorious things are said of you. I will count Egypt and Babylon among those who know me. Also Philistia and Tyre and even distant Ethiopia, they have all become citizens of Jerusalem. What? Those guys are the enemy. They are them. They are the problem. But here we have God. It says, "The Lord, when the Lord registers the nations, he will say, they have all become citizens of Jerusalem." I want to talk about an extravagant welcome. We have, from beginning to end, a picture of a God who is calling all of us in. A God who says there is a place for every single one of us at the table, who calls every single one of us his child. In fact, Luke 18, 15 through 17, right after this, is another amazing, this is another sermon, I should stop. But Luke 18, 15 through 17 is the story of one day some parents brought their little children to Jesus so he could touch and bless them. But when the disciples saw this, they scolded the parents for bothering him. Then Jesus called for the children and said to the disciples, "Let the children come to me. Don't stop them, for the kingdom of God belongs to these." At the time, children were disposable, right? They died so often that you didn't even name them till they were one. Children didn't matter. They had no legal rights. They weren't very important. You just had more. And Jesus is shown calling even them in and saying, "The kingdom, my kingdom, belongs to even these." This is extravagant. This welcome of everyone, from the littlest to the greatest, often in that order. This is what God is calling us to. Jesus says in John 6:37, "Anyone who comes to me, I will in no wise cast out." And we, brothers and sisters, get to bear the image of our Father as well. What if we did that? Anyone who came to us, we wouldn't cast out. Whoever God brings across your path today, I'm not throwing them out. They're here. They belong. What if, like my Aunt Carol, we decided to move over, to make space, to give whatever we could to that person to help them feel like they were home too, that they belonged, that they were taken care of? We are all God's kids. We are all welcome. We all belong. We are at the party. That's the truth of this story, right? It's the father's message to the older son. "Son, this has been a party all along, and you were just missing out because I am always with you. All I have is and has always been yours. Open your eyes and get in here and celebrate." God invites us to change our thinking, to enter the party, whether we're the younger son and think we've wandered off and don't deserve the Father's love, or because we're the older son and we think we really do deserve the Father's love, and why hasn't he been better to me? We're all invited in. That's the beauty of it. We're all the Father's kids, and God is looking for his kids, his sons and daughters, to partner with him in his work of celebration and joy and extravagant love. He's calling us to be people who make space, who extend belonging, and celebrate extravagantly with each and every child of the King. Amen. Let's sing Amazing, I think that's what's up. Oops. I think we're up singing Amazing Grace. Would you